from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out about an event celebrating jazz composer David Baker's 80th birthday.
I'll get a preview of the touring production of Million Dollar Quartet coming to Indy.
And I'll have a chance to sit down one last time with Max Anderson, who'll be leaving the IMA for Dallas at the end of the year. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Jazz legend David Baker is turning 80, and the Jazz Kitchen and Indie Jazz Fest have put together quite the birthday celebration on Wednesday, December 21st, at the Jazz Kitchen. The black tie event features cocktails, dinner, and, of course, some really terrific jazz, all for a good cause, as Sharon Gamble found out recently from a whole gang from Indie Jazz Fest.
So, because we have four voices, and it's radio, I'm going to ask each of you, of course, Mary Beth, your voice will be very distinct, but I'm going to ask each of you to say who you are and how you first became aware of David Baker.
Well, Sharon, I'm Mary Beth Smith, and we have an event consulting business, Mary Beth Smith & Associates, and how I first knew David Baker, I will never forget, was in 1998, when David Baker and Rick Hughes, who was marketing director for the Convention and Visitors Association, asked me out to lunch. And the first thing they said is, "Do you like jazz?" And that's when the conception of the jazz festival started.
Really?
And so I said, "I love jazz." And he said, "Well, we want to talk to you about a little event that we have in mind."
Little. And so, I heard the air quotes around that.
Yeah. But I, you know, ever since then, I have just been such a fan of that wonderful gentleman. And he was just a gentleman through the entire planning time. And he really helped us. He helped guide us as far as musicians and the feel, the ambiance of the event. And so I'll never forget that. And I'm honored to be part of this event.
Brent?
Well, I'm Brent Wallerab, and I am professor of music at Jacobs School of Music down at Indiana University. I first became aware of David Baker when I was a kid, and I first became interested in jazz, and the very first book that I got, jazz book about how to play the music, was by David Baker. And so he became one of my first idols. And so I read all of his books, and I studied with him then in graduate school. I did my undergraduate work at Southern Illinois University, but went to Indiana University for graduate school, and then I studied with David Baker, and since then he's become the greatest mentor in my life, and I'm very proud to say that he's now my boss at Indiana University.
Al?
Yes, my name is Al Hall, and I am the owner of Owl Studios and a principal of the current Indie Jazz Fest, and have been for the last, 3 years now. When did I become aware? I think if you live in Indianapolis or Indiana, one becomes aware of the leaders of certain movements, and David Baker has always been that. I think I met him personally a couple of years ago when he was a participant of the Indy Jazz Fest. More personally, Owl Studios is a sponsor of the Emerging Artist Program, which is a competition among the Jacobs School of Music Jazz Department students to have the Emerging Artist Award. And so we do this. This will be the second year that we will have done this. And David Baker obviously is an integral part of that.
So, lots of connections there.
Looking forward to his birthday, right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And Rob?
Right. I'm Rob Dixon. I work with Owl Studios and Indie Jazz Fest, and a musician. And I first became aware of David Baker probably my senior year in high school. But actually,
do you remember how?
Yes, I was studying with a saxophone teacher in Atlanta who was very well known. His name's Charles Bradley, and he was actually one of the founding members of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, but he played saxophone, alto saxophone, like Cannonball, and he told me about David Baker, and I knew of him, and then I went to school at a college called Hampton University, and I had a friend actually go to graduate school at Indiana University, and he told me, you gotta come to IU, you gotta Dave Baker, and I was like, I know the name. So I, you know, sent an audition tape, and then David said, come on to IU. So I came to Indiana University, and I met everybody. I met Brent that year, my first year there, and was a student of David's, and, you know, have since played in a short stint in the Smithsonian Masterworks Jazz Orchestra, and a couple of, I guess that's my...
All roads lead back.
Right. So, right back to Indiana.
So,
David.
How did this particular crew get the idea to do an 80th birthday celebration? It's not the only ones. We should say IU's doing its own things, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of other activities going on. But how did this particular event come about?
I think it was you, Brent, that sort of came up with the idea and started passing the word around, and didn't take long for us to get very enthusiastic about it.
And so it's on his actual 80th birthday on December 21st at the Jazz Kitchen, where we can expect to hear some fabulous music. But there's dinner, there's cocktails.
Birthday cake.
money is being raised to start a jazz scholarship, as I understand it.
That's right. One of the main purposes of this is not just to celebrate David's life, but he's been so influential in so many people's lives. Jazz is healthy in certain aspects, mainly in the educational world, because of people like David Baker, who's a real pioneer in creating the whole jazz education idea and concept. And he has so many students, and then students of students, and many generations. They number the thousands, and they're in every city across the globe, active jazz participants keeping this music alive. David Baker has had this legacy of teaching, of keeping this music alive and teaching people to teach it and to perform it. And this is another way that we can keep his legacy going, by having a really wonderful scholarship in his name for Indiana University Jacobs School of Music, so we can make sure that we can still find the best and brightest young budding musicians around the country and bring them to be a part of David's legacy for years to come.
It's like the Johnny Appleseed of jazz.
That's right.
You know, just to add to what Brent was saying also, David's not only helped a lot of students, he's helped what I think is legendary musicians in the industry that are based out of Indianapolis, like Freddie Hubbard and J.J. Johnson and, Wes. I think he was a great influence on all these musicians. David is very much an intellectual. I remember when I was at Indiana University, we went to Monaco. There was a jazz festival sponsored by Johnny Walker, believe it or not. And it was. And Freddie Hubbard came to the festival and told everybody, David taught me how to read music, and he taught me this, and he taught me that. And I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. And just talking to some of the musicians that were on Indiana Avenue, Ray Appleton, you know, he always said David did a lot to help the musicians out that played on Indiana Avenue, you know. So his influence is very far-reaching and has helped not only a lot of young students, but legendary musicians, so it goes, you know.
And, you know, Rob, you were talking earlier about the gentleman who was an influence on you in Atlanta, who played in the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra but also was a jazz musician. It strikes me that David Baker, even though you say David Baker to most people in central Indiana and they immediately say jazz, but he's written more than 2,000 compositions spanning jazz, classical, chamber music, film, ballet. And it's kind of a good reminder that we have a bad habit of putting music in little boxes sometimes. But how do you account for that kind of ability to morph among genre? just genius, or there's no explaining it, or we could replicate it, right?
I think, you know, if you study classical music and you study jazz music, I think after that you pretty much, you know, can have a handle on music in general. I think going across other genres, it becomes easy, you know, because you have to, in studying classical and jazz in particular, you have to not only address melody, but harmony and rhythm, and understand it and how harmony relates to melody. And just, it's a very comprehensive understanding of music. And I think those who study classical and classical theory and those who study jazz understand, have a very comprehensive understanding of music, how it works and all the parts. And so it's a very in-depth study of music, and when you study both those genres. So I think playing any type of music after that, you can grasp it pretty easily, I would say.
Yeah, and also if I can add too, when you listen to David Baker's classical music, there's a strong jazz vocabulary in that classical music,
sure.
Whether it's orchestra, chamber, or music, that it's David Baker's voice. And so even though he is so well known and well recorded and well performed all across the globe, international orchestras and chamber orchestras have played his music, there is still that, not just that strong jazz influence, but really that strong Indiana Avenue jazz influence, because there was that Indiana Avenue jazz sound that developed in the 40s and 50s, and people would talk about that regional Indianapolis sound. And so when you hear David's classical music, you still hear the roots of not just jazz, but that very special kind of brand of jazz, something mm-hmm. we can all be proud of.
Mary Beth, tell us about the flow of this evening. What can people expect?
Well, before we even started, Sharon, we had a wow session. And the wow session is trying to get a group of very creative people together and capture the essence of David Baker. Mm-hmm. And so we did that, and it ended up being... that David is, while he's a wonderful, wonderful musician and composer, he's also an elegant man, and he's a gentleman,
mm-hmm.
in every sense of the word. So what we're doing is, I love it, it's black tie, and it's in the jazz kitchen, and it's going to be elegant. And so we're capturing his favorite foods, and the students will be there, and they will be playing. And Brent, you should tell about the performance by the orchestra. I think the whole evening will really capture what David is all about, and we're looking forward to it.
And let's hear about the music. What do we get to hear?
Well, the Biseli Wallereb Jazz Orchestra is going to be performing a set of David Baker's big band music, which is rarely ever performed outside of Indiana University.
Hmm.
We talked about David's classical music. That's heavily recorded and performed by orchestras nationally and internationally. In fact, he has a rather large discography of his classical music. But as far as his jazz big band music, where he's composed hundreds of those, they're hardly ever performed outside of Indiana University, and they've never been recorded before, other than when the Biseli Wallereb Jazz Orchestra recorded his music in 2005, I believe it was. And so it's a great opportunity for people to hear this music that you just don't hear very much, and it's really David in his element. It sounds amazing. And we recorded this album before... Well, actually, we recorded it right as Owl Studios started to develop.
Mm-hmm.
And it was with another record label, because Owl Studios hadn't been developed right at that time. And that record label really let that great recording languish. It was noted by Downbeat Magazine as one of the top 100 jazz albums of the decade. But you couldn't get it anywhere. It wasn't marketed. You couldn't order it anywhere. And so it just sat there.
Well, that's
and
tragic.
It is, except... Then we have the our hero of jazz here in Indianapolis, Al Hall, who has, after literally years of wrangling with this other record company, managed to get the masters and the rights to this album finally. And we are in the process right now putting the finishing touches on remixing it, remastering it, re-editing it, and repackaging it under the Owl Studios label, and so it will be available for David's birthday, and we're really excited about that.
Fantastic. Well done.
And I have to add, there's no such thing as a free lunch, because if you will have the opportunity that evening to contribute to the scholarship fund. The price of the dinner is really nominal when you think of all that they're getting in terms of food and the entertainment. It's $80 in honor of his birthday. But if you do feel so compelled to give to the scholarship fund, you will receive a CD of this David Baker album. We won't let you out the door unless you give, though. But, you know, why wouldn't you? Because it's such a worthy cause, and I think people will feel compelled to give.
And that scholarship might contribute to another musician coming up, mm-hmm. like some of the fellas in the room right now, I'm just saying.
The other thing that we're going to be offering is a new book that just got released that was edited by Monica Herzig, which are recollections of other of the, as you say, famous musicians and their recollections and their memories of David Baker. And it's called, I forget what the name of it is, but it is basically David Baker.
David Baker, A Legacy in Music, mm-hmm. I believe.
Thank That's you. It. So we'll have that available that evening, too. So everybody will be talking about that.
Sharon Gamble with representatives from the Indy Jazz Fest. The David Baker Birthday Celebration is a black tie event on Wednesday, December 21st at the Jazz Kitchen. That's 5377 North College Avenue in Indianapolis. For more tickets and information, visit thejazzkitchen.com. Again, thejazzkitchen.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. On December 4th, 1956, an auspicious twist of fate brought Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Elvis Presley together at Sun Records in Memphis. This was the only time these four musicians ever recorded together. That story and the music is revisited in the national tour of Million Dollar Quartet, the Tony Award-winning musical, coming to Indy this month. Travis DiNicola spoke with the musical director Chuck Mead of the country band BR549 by phone about the show.
Chuck, thanks so much for being on the phone with us for Art of the Matter Day. It's great to chat with you.
Well, it's fantastic to be here. I appreciate you calling me.
Absolutely. This is going to be a great show. I know a lot of people in Indianapolis are looking forward to it coming here on tour. But let me just start with asking you about, give us some background. What happened on December 4th, 1956, that made it such an incredible night and made it worth creating a musical about?
Well, December 4th, 1956 was the one and only time that Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins, and Jerry Lee Lewis were all together at Sun Records at one time, the place where they all started. And the situation was that it was a Carl Perkins recording session. He was recording the song Matchbox that was later on recorded by the Beatles.
Okay.
And yeah, exactly. And so it was it's a rockabilly classic.
Yeah.
And Jerry Lee Lewis was just starting out. He had made one record for Sun Records. It was Crazy Arms, and he was hired as the side musician, piano player, for this Carl Perkins record.
Okay.
So he wasn't even a star yet at all. So they had this recording session in, and then Elvis calls and says, well, you know, I'm home for Christmas. And Elvis at the time was like the biggest star ever.
Yeah.
He'd just done Love Me Tender. He was filming his second movie. He had hit records out. It was all looking good for Elvis at that point. He was 21 years old, and he brought a girlfriend of his from Las Vegas. In our show, she comes from California, but you know we had to change things.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he's coming home for Christmas, and Sam Phillips, who was the guy that owned Sun Records,
sure.
who was the impresario, who was really sort of a father figure in this whole deal because he helped all these guys realize their true potential as a recording artist. He calls Sam up, and Sam calls Johnny Cash up and said, get down here because Elvis is coming. So they all show up, and they all end up jamming.
And how big was Johnny Cash then? I mean, he was a pretty big deal too, right?
Johnny Cash had already had a hit record with I Walk the Line and Folsom Prison Blues.
Okay.
And, you know, they all a year before that, before Elvis exploded, they were all on the road together.
Yeah.
Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash and Elvis, they were all on the road traveling around in cars. And Jerry Lee hadn't even come to Sun yet.
Yeah. Wow.
So that's how fast things move in the music business, you know, sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes. Back
when
then.
There are no rules. when you're making up the rules as you go along. Uh-huh. So anyway, they ended up jamming, and Cowboy Jack Clement, a very dear friend of mine who does not appear in the play except for as a tape recorder, which I was the one that had to break the news to him that he was represented as a tape recorder, turned on the tape machine and recorded what they came up with. And mostly it was sitting around the piano, talking about music, talking about Chuck Berry, playing a Chuck Berry song, talking about gospel music, because that was their one main thread that they had together. They all knew gospel songs, mm-hmm. so they sang a bunch of those. And so it was a nice little moment, and it was kind of lost to history for many, many years.
Well, let me get this straight. So they didn't just record music. There was actually a recording of their conversations?
Oh, yeah. It was nice. The tapes just ran.
Yeah.
And it's available. It's widely available
yeah.
now.
Okay.
For a while, it was just part of it available back in the 70s when I first got the record version of it.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's all out.
Yeah.
And you can hear them talking and joking around with each other and singing songs. And it's just fantastic. And so my good friend Colin Escott, who has written the probably definitive Hank Williams biography, and also wrote the biography of Sun Records, co-wrote with Floyd Mutrix a treatment for the Million Dollar Quartet.
Mm-hmm.
And we incorporate a lot of that stuff that actually happened, and we call it our little hillbilly skit with a lot of good rock and roll music.
That sounds like a ton of fun. Now, how did you get involved? I mean, you've been in the music business a long time. I mean, certainly with your band, BR549, and the work that you've been doing, and great, just really fun sort of rockabilly and country music that you do. But how did you get involved with this?
Well, BR549 was kind of going on hiatus at that point, in about 2006. And I was doing some other things and, you know, still writing songs. And I got a call from Colin, and he said, well, I've written this treatment for the Million Dollar Quartet. Have you ever thought about being the musical director for a Broadway play? And I'm like, no.
Right.
You know, I'm a hillbilly singer, right? Guitar player. And he said, well, take a look at this thing. Because it was Colin, so I knew it was going to be cool. And I looked at it, and it seemed like a great story, about 18 months of actual things that happened in history,
mm-hmm.
it condensed into an hour and a half, hour 40-minute long little skit that was pretty clever and pretty great. It had all the music of my life anyway
yeah.
involved in it, and so I said yes. And even though I'd never worked in the musical theater before, I did know how to produce a country record, and so that's kind of how I approached the whole thing. We showed up and we had band practice, and we make everybody a band, because unlike a lot of musicals, what you mm-hmm. see is what you get on stage. The guy playing Jerry Lee
mm-hmm.
is playing the piano and singing and acting like Jerry Lee. And same with Elvis and Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash. They're all actually playing on stage. There's no taped music. There's no pantomiming. There's a doghouse bass player, a drummer. And that's our band.
So they're all musicians and actors. So let me ask you about that. I mean, did the guys that make up the show here, I mean, did they come to the production as actors first, musicians first? I mean, it had to be different, though, working with them as opposed to working with a regular band.
Well, characteristically, you have to the way that it's been working since I've been on board is that you kind of mm-hmm. have to be lean towards the musician side,
yeah.
but it helps to be an actor too. But that being said, the original Johnny Cash, who's still playing in New York, Lance Guest, who we all know from The Last Starfighter, has been playing Johnny. He's an actor first, but he's also a good musician.
Yeah,
and he learned how to play this music because, you know, that's what we do. We just go to country school, and then we try to make everything sound like a good country record every night.
That has to be a lot of fun.
Which is the half of rock and roll. Then there's the R&B half too that mm-hmm. is unpredictable, and so we still have that too because unlike all other musicals, it's not exactly the same every night. So, you know, when a guy gets a 12-bar solo,
mm-hmm.
he can do whatever he wants with it. As long as it sounds like Jerry Lee or Carl Perkins. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right, so these guys are really learning to play in the style, not just playing the character, but really learning to play in the style. And I mean, it sounds as much like a concert as, I mean, a real concert as it is a Broadway show.
Well, in a lot of ways it is. But you're like a fly on the wall watching these guys play for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really a concert because they're playing for their own enjoyment.
Okay,
And they hadn't seen each other for a long time, and there's there's an intellectualism that goes along with the story that drives that the music drives, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think I got it.
The other way around in musical theater. And so it's a really unique situation, and you've got to find a lot of really talented people, and we've been really lucky.
Mm-hmm.
We have a New York production, a Chicago production, a London production, and now the touring production, and so that's a lot of really talented people to be able to pull that off.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's satisfaction,
Sure.
And a lot of it is just making everybody a band, so you play together like a band.
So out of those four musicians, who's the hardest to cast?
Oh, well, they're all hard for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Cash needs to have this gravitas that that nobody else has, and the delivery and a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's hard to find, and a guy that can act too.
Sure.
And then you got Carl Perkins, who's the band leader and has to be able to play guitar, but has to be just a little bit Carl Perkins and a little bit on edge, because they were all on edge back then.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Elvis is so incredibly iconic. I mean, that's hard to do,
yeah,
to find somebody that talented to do. And then Jerry Lee, which is, really difficult, because you have to be completely, unbelievable piano player to do it. and at the same time, be able to...
A little bit crazy?
A little crazy, exactly. A little unpredictable.
Yeah.
So, probably all the people that play Jerry Lewis in all of our productions are just a little bit insane. But that's what makes it entertaining to watch.
Hey, something else that's kind of insane and entertaining that I want to mention is, we were talking about this before we went on the air, Sun King Brewery here in Indianapolis is doing something special for Million Dollar Quartet. They are tapping a keg at the Rathskeller of a beer that they have created called the Million Dollar Brewski. And so... Chuck, I mean, this sounds pretty cool. I mean, you've heard about this? You want to come up and try some?
I have heard about it, and I'm really tempted to drive all the way from Nashville up there just to try this beer. Because it sounds great. They did their homework. It's based on a beer that was sort of a local brew around Memphis at the time that was sort of an Oktoberfest beer,
mm-hmm,
but a little bit lighter. And I think that they've reproduced it, and I'd love to try it. I'm an expert,
Yeah. Well, I think we need to get you up here for that. I know a lot of people in town here are looking for it. Sun King does a lot of great, crazy stuff, and everyone in town's a big fan. I think this is the first time, though, they've created a signature beer tied into a musical. So congratulations on that,
Well, that's terrific. I'm taking that back to whoever it matters to. But it matters to me. I think it's terrific.
Yeah.
So like I said, I'll waste some gas money to come up and try that beer.
That'd be okay. Hey, before I let you go, tell me what's up next for you.
I have a record that comes out in February,
mm-hmm,
called Back at the Quonset Hut, and it kind of goes along with what I've been doing with Million Dollar Quartet, in so much as that it's a classic country record, all songs, from the 50s and the 60s. I recorded it at the very first studio that was built on Music Row up here in Nashville,
okay,
called the Quonset Hut, and I recorded it with a bunch of what they call the A-Team Nashville Pickers, which are the guys that played on virtually every record in the 50s and the 60s. And there's four of those guys that played on my record with me, with a bunch of guest stars. And it comes out February 28th.
Excellent. We'll be looking forward to that, too. And maybe we can get a beer related to that one as well. We'll see, huh?
Well, now, I'm going to push for that one.
It sounds like a plan. Hey, Chuck, real pleasure chatting with you. It's been a lot of fun. I can't wait to see the show. Looking forward to hearing some great music. And thanks a lot for all the work you've done with us.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm sure everybody will have a great time going to this show, because I always do, and I've seen it a whole lot.
Travis DiNicola with musician and producer Chuck Mead. Mead is also the music director for the national tour of Million Dollar Quartet, which is coming to Indianapolis from December 13th through the 18th at the Old National Center as part of the Broadway in Indianapolis series. More information is available at milliondollarquartetlive.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
It's that time of year when there are lots of movie releases.
So you know, true.
There's all sorts of great, serious movies that are held back until December and released just in time to qualify for Oscar nominations for
right.
next year. And then there are the kind of goofy escapist fare like We Bought a Zoo.
Right.
Well, you don't have to buy a zoo, but I have an event taking place at the zoo on our calendar that we call.
What do we do?
You had no idea where I was
like,
going.
Where are you
going with these movies?
Yeah. We bought a zoo. There's a lot going on at the zoo.
There's a lot going on at the zoo, particularly Christmas at the zoo. Millions of twinkling lights scattered throughout the entire... Well, they're not scattered. They were actually very carefully placed, but they're throughout the entire zoo grounds. There's more than 150 larger-than-life light sculptures around the zoo, featuring holiday scenes and animal favorites, including lions, penguins, and giraffes. There are timed flashing light, campfire singers, carolers, live animal feeds, and rides. And Christmas at the zoo continues through December 30th. The zoo is closed Mondays, Tuesdays, and Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. But otherwise, take the little animals in your life to see the big animals at the zoo.
That should be lots of fun. And of course, Santa will be there too.
That's right.
Well, when you started talking about serious movies and goofy movies, my thoughts of course went to our resident movie expert Matt Soucy.
Yes,
because if you would like to see a production that he has directed and also features a cameo appearance by Mr. Matthew Soucy, then you can go see a 1940s radio production of It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, he was telling me about this. This is great.
Which is actually taking place at Anderson University in Byram Hall this weekend. Curtain is 7:30 Friday and Saturday, and then there's a 2:30 matinee on Sunday. And then next weekend at Theater on the Square, downtown Indianapolis, curtain's at 8 p.m. on December 16th and 17th, and a 2:30 matinee on the 18th. Again, it's a 1940s radio production of It's a Wonderful Life, and it's directed by and features our Matthew Soucy in a cameo. Should be very fun.
How'd they get him in a cameo?
I don't know. I've never... I'm trying to imagine what cameo he plays in this, but that alone may be worth
is
seeing.
Is he Clarence?
I don't know. We'll have to find out, Sharon.
I could describe Clarence, but I'm not going there. Family-friendly performances. How about A Year with Frog and Toad is a whole nother adult-themed play. Frog and Toad. Like the hockey.
Like a ribbit.
Like the ones up at the Children's Museum. A Year with Frog and Toad, a delightful and charming musical that Actors Theater of Indiana is bringing back as its holiday show December 16, 17, and 18. Just three performances, so make plans soon. Actors Theater of Indiana is doing that.
Hey, want to mention some cool stuff going on at the State Fairgrounds next weekend, which includes the Salvation Army Christmas City Toy Shop in the Exposition Hall, which should be very, very fun. And then there's also the Great Train Expo taking place in the Marsh Blue River Pavilion, where they have great train displays, and of course you can buy trains. And then there's also the YMCA and U.S. Marine Corps Toys for Tots going on as well, so you can buy some toys and donate them and drop them off. And then if that is enough for you, well, our Naptown Roller Girls will be taking on the Toronto's CN Power up at the fairgrounds as well that weekend with Naptown Roller Girls. So should be a lot of fun at the State Fairground next weekend.
Well, that was a pretty diverse series of events you just promoted.
Well, you know, there's also, by the way, the Indiana and Illinois Farm and Outdoor Power Equipment Show going on as well. So try not to get too confused.
Maybe you...
Or go ice skating.
Maybe
you know,
there's I did not make it ice skating last year. I was doing laundry in my basement and saw my ice skates last night, and I thought, I need to go ice skating
this
year. That's right. Connor Prairie by Candlelight. You can discover how holidays like Christmas and Hanukkah were celebrated in 1836. You can visit various homes in Prairie Town during a 60-minute guided tour. Enjoy the Ullman's Hanukkah celebration and meet the German Pennsylvania Santa Claus. Reservations are required for this, but family friendly. It's up at Connor Prairie, that beautiful reenactment facility in Noblesville. So that is Connor Prairie by candlelight. Give them a call and take your family there.
You know, something that's been interesting that's been going on the past couple weeks, a group of some local filmmakers who have created a documentary titled Science, Sex, and the Ladies.
Uh-huh.
They have been trying to get funding to get their movie made and released, and they've been working through Kickstarter, which is an online campaign to raise money for for-profits for projects like this. But they've really been pushing it, and definitely want to give them a shout-out, because I know that they're trying to raise the money that they need by next weekend. And I'll let you just go on to Kickstarter and then search Science, Sex, and the Ladies to find out how to pledge and also what the movie's about, because it certainly sounds interesting.
And they were on this very program about 3 years ago and had already started working on this. So this is a long, long-term dream of these three talented filmmakers. Not absolutely everything on our calendar is particularly about the winter holidays. For example, On View Now just opened last week. Art of the American Indians, the Thaw Collection, the Eugene and Claire Thaw Collection of North American Indian Art. It comprises more than 800 masterpieces of Native American art spanning more than 2,000 years. And this exhibit features more than 80 of the most outstanding works among those 800, and it's on view at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, but just through February 12th. Just through February 12th of next year. So you better hustle if you want to see that.
Very good. Hey, the Indianapolis Men's Choruses, they are having their Christmas Cards concert and featuring their 50-man-strong ensemble. And they are giving performances on Saturday, December 17th at Broadway United Methodist, as well as on Sunday, December 18th at All Saints Episcopal. You can get more information at indiechoruses.org, but it should be a great show both nights.
Very good. I know you probably heard Travis's interview a couple of weeks ago about what's going on at the ISO at this time of year, but don't forget the Yuletide celebration is going on through December 23rd at Hilbert Circle Theater. Liz Calloway and Hampton Calloway are your hosts. Jack Everly is the music director. And you can see stars from the fan favorite Cirque de la Symphonie.
That should be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I like them. And also Messiah is coming up that they will be performing December 17th at Clues Memorial Hall. Lots of great concerts there. Hey, the Indianapolis Arts Center is doing something called Pop Up for the Holidays.
I love this
idea. Yes, yes. They've got a whole bunch of little pop-up classes, sort of short sampler classes that you can take that are going on now through the end of the year. And they include classes. There's some winter exhibitions going on, but there's also some really fun classes that they are offering in ceramics and glass and painting and drawing and photography and jewelry and steel and all sort of types of stuff. You need to go to Indianapolis Art Center. That's their website. It's indplsartcenter.org and look up pop-ups for more information.
How do you pronounce that again?
Yeah. Indianapolis Art Center.
Oh, dear. Another opportunity, actually two other opportunities to hear Handel's Messiah, different performance, with Tabernacle Presbyterian Church Choir and the Fairview Presbyterian Church Choir, joining the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra, plus soloists, of course. These performances are Saturday, December 10th, that's this weekend, and Sunday, December 11th, Saturday performance at 7:30, Sunday performance at 3 o'clock at Tabernacle Presbyterian Church. Another opportunity to hear and see Messiah.
Very good. Very good. Well, Sharon, lots of great things to do to celebrate the arts and lots of good gift ideas and things to do as people are getting ready
for
the holidays.
Chocolate.
We like chocolate, too. We will be back next week with just a few more last-minute arts gift ideas on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Maxwell Anderson, the Melvin and Bren Simon director and CEO of the Indianapolis Museum of Art for the last 5 years, leaves an era of great change in his wake as he transitions to his new role as director of the Dallas Museum of Art. Sharon Gamble wanted to know what drew him to Indianapolis, how the city and the IMA have changed him, and what he'll miss about the Circle City.
Tell me what attracted you to the Indianapolis Museum of Art in the first place.
probably too many things to recount, Sharon. It was a combination of a well-known museum and a very strong board that I learned about in the interview process, an accomplished staff, great collection, recently completed capital project, which meant no big capital project on the horizon, and a city that telegraphed an interest in cultural aspiration.
And yet we're so modest sometimes here, and it's not even just the natives who are modest. Lots of times people move here. I used to work at the Children's Museum with Peter Sterling, who had moved here from Boston, and he used to get so frustrated. He'd say, in Boston, you'd have a disagreement with somebody, and you'd have fisticuffs, and you'd take each other out for a beer, but things progress. Whereas here, everybody is so nice.
Well, nice is a double-edged sword. I think everybody is nice on the surface in lots of places, but then people are paddling underwater really fast. So I don't consider there to be a we in any city. I think there's a lot of us and different points of view in different parts of the city and different levels of aspiration and ambition.
It strikes me that one of the challenges of leaving a place where you've made such a difference is that your legacy will continue to unfold for years, given the planning cycle of any institution, but in particular the planning cycle required by an art museum and the planning cycle that I suspect you stretched out even beyond, years beyond. What is still going to happen at the IMA that you started that you won't be here to bask in the glory of?
Oh, well, basking in the glory isn't really the end result anyway. It's making sure that everything happens as it best supports the institution and the city. But you're kind to say it. I think it's true. Most museums of our scale have exhibition calendars planned out 3 years in advance, which is the case at the IMA. So there are a lot of phenomenal projects on the books. I'm not saying that the interim leadership or my successor won't take a red pen and say, we're going to tear up this contract. That does happen, and it's to be expected that it may happen. I would say the most exciting things ahead include the Design Arts collection of 1,000 works going on permanent display in a large gallery space, the largest in the Western Hemisphere, actually. And I think the other major endeavors involve the reinstallation of the African collection, supported by Eli Lilly and Company, in a staggering, fresh display that will give great life to the Idle Jor collection in a new space. And the Asian collection beckons, which is at the moment being studied by James Watt, who's the Brooke Astor Chairman Emeritus of the Metropolitan Museum of Art's Asian Department. He's with us as a curator at large for a year, thanks to the Mellon Foundation in New York. So there are a lot of parts moving around the permanent collection, which is the next great chapter, in addition to some phenomenal exhibitions coming, one that's now at the Van Gogh Museum that we organized with them and with the Phillips Collection in Washington, a suite of Renaissance tapestries from 1470 made for King Afonso V that are 38 feet wide. And there are four of them.
Oh, my.
And they're currently on view at the National Gallery of Art for your listeners. So there's a lot in the pipeline, but there's also a lot of opportunity for a new director to come in and shape the plans and premises as she or he chooses.
You also have some programs begun in the educational field that are going to come to fruition. Can you tell us about those? Because I don't think they're quite as well known to the public, certainly as they are to the field.
Well, we set a research paradigm in place with our strategic plan that the board adopted at the end of last year, and part of that has to do with visitor studies. So we have now four PhDs in the field of audience engagement and education, and they're working away at some new premises of how we can better understand our audiences and what propels them into the IMA or what keeps them away from the IMA and what we can do as a museum's to better address the interests of our visitors. And I think that's an extraordinary area of research that, frankly, art museums are late to the game in doing. Science museums and natural history museums have been doing this along with history museums for many years. But art museums are slow, conservative, plodding places. So we've been slow as a field. And it's a new area of enterprise that's very exciting, as was the introduction of science and a laboratory in science at the IMA almost 2 years ago.
What attracted you to the visual arts in the first place?
I actually have a book coming out, which is something I never thought I would be saying next
in
January, called The Quality Instinct. And it is a 70,000-word meditation on how the visual arts became a kind of addiction for me and how I looked at art and learned to study art. And so I think all the answers are in that book for your listeners.
Oh, no, but you have to get... Okay, so you have to give us some... Tease us a little bit.
I would say I had a very fortunate childhood, not because of wealth. My parents were solidly middle class, but life experiences abroad. My dad taught American literature, and he had a sabbatical leave from Columbia University, and we lived in France for a year, and we lived in England for a year when I was 6 and 10, respectively. And that really shaped who I am as a person. It gave me an understanding of the world around us creatively and visually that was very hard to get in concrete island of Manhattan.
You've made reference in various places, both scholarly publications and interviews, to the role contemporary art has, and contemporary design in particular has, and how it is the portal through which many of us access visual intelligence in the first place.
Well, it's an old saw to say that all art was contemporary at one point. So I think the most valuable thing encyclopedic museums like the IMA can do is to remember that and to make possible for visitors a fresh perspective, even on works of art that are 1,000 years old, to rekindle the artist's intention. And if we always go back to that, it's harder to fail. If we always go back to what the artist was after rather than how we may have overlaid centuries or decades of cultural bias, we have a better shot at seeing ourselves in connection with past creative heritage. And I think contemporary art is simply the noise of everything around us. There's very bad contemporary art, as there's very good contemporary art. But the ratio is unknown to us today. And we have a very talented leader in contemporary art at the IMA, Lisa Fryman, who with Sarah Green and their colleague Amanda York, the three of them work intensively, along with Veronica Roberts, who's a full-time curator in New York who works for the IMA, to really push the envelope and ask questions. But every other curator and every other staff member benefits from that type of enterprise.
Absolutely. You know, you've just addressed this a little bit, but what in your lifetime has changed in the ways museums interact with public and vice versa, and the roles, our respective roles, visual arts patron, museum?
We're very protective by nature because our primary job in the past, anyway, was to be stewards of precious things. And that doesn't naturally come with either an adventurous spirit or necessarily one that says, come in and touch and smell and taste these things, they're all for you. So it breeds a care in how we work as professionals in museums.
A lot of caution.
A lot of caution and an aversion to taking chances. And I think one of the pleasures of having been here for 5.5 years was that the board gave me a lot of room to take chances. And I, in turn, gave the staff as much room as they cared to have. So it led to a lot of efforts to broaden how we connected with visitors, whether it was going to a free general admission program or looking for exhibitions that were compelling and that we could organize ourselves and travel, which to me is a key marker of the success of an institution. It's not simply what you bring to town, it's what you have in your city and then goes out on the road that really marks your reputation. So I would say part of the issue for any art museum, and specifically the IMA, in terms of visitors, is figuring out the path into all sorts of interesting ways of understanding and connecting with creativity. And that can be the 100-acre park. It can be the interest that some visitors may have in a highly specialized area of collecting. Or it could be more generally learning that furniture in their home actually is in an art museum. And why is that?
Mm-hmm. Speaking of paths, I had the fortune of being in a meeting with you recently where you talked about one more significant job in your career. Do you have, this might be in your book too, it's another reason to buy the book, but do you have a lifelong plan of what you want to accomplish in your work, or?
Well, that would be terrifying. I mean, that would be the end of thinking about yourself if you're not always trying to look at what's possible in your life, as opposed to the finite certainty of where you're heading. And no, I don't. I would say the premise for me around working in an art museum is the pleasure of being around other people who care about creative history and learning from them about their expertise and trying to give them the tools they need to succeed. That's the single greatest pleasure of the job. And it so happens that there are intervals in your personal life when the connection with whatever position you have changes or shifts and you think about opportunities differently. So I certainly never set about when we arrived here thinking about leaving. I was focused on doing.
Sure.
And the temptation to leave was a function of, as the mafia says, an offer you can't refuse. So it wasn't so much a plan of any kind.
What will you miss about the IMA and about this community?
Well, so many things. And it's very poignant to look at, as you said, projects yet to happen, because you're very invested in those, obviously. And the team that is at the IMA today is a remarkably capable, mature, professional team that's been through a lot with the recession and frankly, with layoffs and cutbacks like so many other organizations and corporations throughout the country during the recession. We lopped $7 million off of our annual operating budget, which meant that a lot of people left. It meant a lot of sacrifice on the part of those who stayed. So what that also led to, however, was a coalescence of purpose and mission among those at the museum today. And I think that spirit is what I'll miss most, is that sense of possibility and optimism and the absence of fear. And I think purging fear from the language of my colleagues on the staff was the single basic great accomplishment that I can feel good about.
Sharon Gamble with Maxwell Anderson, the outgoing Melvin and Bren Simon Director and CEO of the Indianapolis Museum of Art. He assumes his post as director of the Dallas Museum of Art in early January.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4 when I meet a young author who's written and illustrated a delightful book to raise money for an orphanage.
I'll learn about the educational outreach programs at Clues Memorial Hall.
And I'll chat with artist Flounder Lee about his work and recent travels. Plus, we'll also have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.